yourselves.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday on the Radio Northwest Network, and I want to talk about the so-called Climate Commitment Act. Yeah, that grand legacy of Climate Jay Inslee, former governor of the state of Washington. And what he promised people in the state was, if you just allow us to put a little carbon tax on anything that involves the generation of power, anything that involves fossil fuels, anything involving gasoline, diesel, propane, natural gas, let us put a little carbon tax on that. It'll be kind of like California. Well, he managed to get the idea through. The public has not been able to defeat this crazy idea. So the Climate Commitment Act is there. Do you know how much money it's brought in the last 2 years? Almost $4 billion has been brought in by the so-called Climate Commitment Act. And what was the inherent promise in what they did? They said, why, we will have programs that will reduce the amount of CO2 going into the air. That is our commitment to the climate. You know what? They've spent almost all of it on more government, already spending it on programs that existed already, already spending it on things that don't do much of anything to fix whatever you think the climate's problem is. Let me get into the details of that out of a report from the Washington Policy Center. But first, welcome to a Monday. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you want to answer our poll on X, we put up a brand new poll question each and every day. Today, I thought we'd talk about Ghislaine Maxwell. Now, if you don't remember, she is the madam or human trafficker, whichever you want to call it, who went out and arranged for children, most of them girls, to be available for sex with Jeffrey Epstein, the pedophile, convicted pedophile, who had been convicted once already. He got a sweetheart deal the first time. He was on his way to being convicted of much more serious crimes the second time when he mysteriously died in custody. Some people say he committed suicide. I don't buy it. I think he was killed because I think he had dirt on so many powerful people, politically powerful people. I mean, the kind of circles this guy operated in. You had people like Bill Gates with billions and billions of dollars. You had high-level politicians like Bill Clinton, you know, the horny hick from Arkansas, who took dozens of trips down to the place that was known as Jeffrey Epstein's Sex Island. He traveled on that airplane that got the moniker Lolita Express. Ghislaine Maxwell was the human trafficker who made that happen. And why is it I'm able to call her a human trafficker? Because she was convicted of crimes as well. She's got about 20 years to do in prison. Only lately, she has been talking to members of Congress. And what the thinking is that she's looking for some kind of presidential pardon. So I decided to ask it this way, because as you know, sometimes the cops go out and they get the big offenders by rolling up the small offenders. If you're trying to take down a major league drug trafficker, you find some of the street level people that are selling the drugs on the street. You get them to turn state's evidence and give up what they know in exchange for lighter treatment under the law. Would you trade a Ghislaine Maxwell pardon if they could prosecute some of the perverts that she identifies for them? Because, as I said, there were some high-level people who are close friends to Jeffrey Epstein. Does that mean that anybody who was a friend of Jeffrey Epstein was, in fact, guilty of sexual crimes against children? I don't think you can draw that conclusion at all. You'd have to make the case that there were people provided with children for sex and that they ought to face the full consequences of the law. They should be indicted, they should be tried, and if found guilty, they should go to some deep, dark prison. Or maybe be put out in the general population of the prison and just let nature take its course. But if Ghislaine Maxwell could actually give up the information, and if it leads to the prosecuting of perverts that she identifies, and if she identifies them, that means they're the ones that are still out there, probably still preying on children. If she can deliver that kind of information, is that worth a presidential pardon? I'll give a qualified yes. If what she tells the Congress, who then tells the Department of Justice, if that leads to the prosecution of, say, five of those perverts out there, then as far as I'm concerned, she can get a presidential pardon. Anything short of that, no deal whatsoever. You can find the poll on X today at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, let me get back to the Climate Commitment Act. And that question is this. You've raised $4 billion by increasing taxes on anything that burns that involves carbon. Gasoline, diesel, propane, natural gas. That has resulted in the state of Washington collecting $4 billion. Well, the Washington Policy Center reports, what have they spent the money on? They have spent it on public transit, which we already have. They have spent it on electric ferries to go over Puget Sound primarily. They have spent it on so-called CO2 reduction programs. The state operating budget includes $174 million from CO2 taxes that supposedly is going to go to making the climate better. But about 70% of that spending, according to the Washington Policy Center, is actually just increasing the size of government or paying for more government planning. In other words, they're going to get money that will pay for their efforts to try to plan the thing they're going to do next. And as the report says, much of the spending that claims to mitigate the impact of climate is actually used to hire more government employees or do more government studies. And because there was a new budget shortfall, the governor, Governor Ferguson, who now has his first approval ratings out, and they are some of the lowest approval ratings of any Washington governor, brand new Washington governor in his first term, he is not exactly wowing the public right now. Take a look at how they spend some of this money. Money was spent $382,000 for staff members to lead cross-agency coordination for wildfire and extreme heat emergency management. $382,000 to do better fire planning. Is that part of making the climate better? The second largest expenditure from the Commitment Act, $22.5 million to fund local government planning for climate change. In other words, we think the water is going to come up a little bit higher in the rivers because of this or that or the other thing, and you're going to give them $22 million. 18% of the money is funding to reduce the impact of CO2 taxes on energy bills by providing utility bill assistance. Well, excuse me, but if you go out and pay some of somebody's electric bill, do you think they're going to use less electricity or more if somebody else is paying for part of the bill? The report goes on to say that about $90 million goes to government bureaucracy, $30 million for planning, $35 million for other services, and $15.8 million for actual projects related to the climate. Does that sound like a Climate Commitment Act to you, or just another way for government to fund a much bigger government? It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Just listen for 5 minutes. You'll feel better. More with Lars Larson right now.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense? chance.
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, they do say that you can't fight City Hall, but apparently public pressure works when it comes to the corrupt governor's office of Tina Kotek. Farm stand regulations written by Kotek's bureaucrats had threatened to put some farmers out of business. Remember, regulations are written by folks not elected by the voters and certainly not answerable in any direct way to citizens. Oregon claims it protects farming with laws and policies, urban growth boundaries, and all the rest of that stuff. Then the state turns around and declares that farmers may only do things on their own land that are directly related to farming. So if you run a corn maze or a pumpkin patch, that's okay. But don't you dare sell cider or hot chocolate to the people who come and see the pumpkin patch. Other rules make it hard to host a concert or stage a bucolic wedding. Those things bring in extra income, which often means make or break for the farmers. Just as the new rules were about to roll in, Governor Kotek finally acquiesced on Friday. That's a relief from a governor who usually only gives a damn about things that happen in Portland, where most of the voters live. It's kind of transactional that way. They vote for her. She cares about them. Funny how Kotek and company can run political campaigns on stolen marijuana money. That's an ag product. And then peddle influence directly from her office. But if a farmer wants to sell, say, blueberry muffins, they're going to put him out of business. Our question of the day is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Jim Arter writes in. So let me get this straight, Lars. Jeff Merkley, U.S. Senator, thinks that federal agents should have to wear tags that identify what agency they're with. And he says that when they wear masks, it's anti-fascism. This is the same guy who didn't have a problem with Antifa when they wear masks. A Democrat accusing a Republican conservative of being anti-fascism, that's rich. Thanks for your time, signed Jim. And my favorite post on X today. Actually, there were so many, I had to choose two. Number one. A man who tried to rob a civilian in Gladstone, Oregon, fled the scene, but then was quickly discovered by police because he has tattoos on his face of devil horns on his forehead. And then he has the word F, I can't say the word on radio, cops over his eyebrows. The story reminded me of a tattooed Portland rioter who vandalized a business, was arrested and released that night, for which he rejoined the riot and tried to burn the federal courthouse and got rearrested again twice in one night. The second one, though, is this one. Has to do with a Democrat member of the state legislature in Washington from Real Safe Seattle. Somebody filed a formal complaint against socialist candidate Sean Scott because he spent his campaign donations, $333 each, on his expensive haircuts. The complaint stated the Public Disclosure Commission has already ruled that haircuts are not an allowable campaign expense. Scott responded that he has to look good for the voters, and he's going to keep giving his money to Jesus, or Jesus, until the PDC tells him not to. If Scott were white, the Seattle Times and other local media would be on this story like body lice on a $2 hooker. But in Seattle, one thing you never do is criticize a black guy about what he does with his hair, unless you are Safe Seattle. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to the idea that in Washington State, starting last Sunday, they have increased the cost of marriage licenses. Now, why they're doing this, I'll tell you why the state says they're doing it, and it's a really stupid idea. Am I worried about buying a new marriage license? No. Tina and I are now up to 28 years happily married. I don't have to worry about buying marriage licenses. But something about this struck me funny. They say they're going to raise the cost by $100. So it went from $69. I don't know why you have to buy a license at all and get the state's permission to get married. You shouldn't have to, but they've raised it from $69 to $169. As far as I'm concerned, government is one of the enemies of marriage. Government does everything it can to make marriage difficult. They make everything they do everything they can not to help with marriages, even though I think marriages are very healthy for society. But what are they going to do with the money? They're going to dedicate the money to domestic violence. Now, my question is, why punish those who are just getting married to fund domestic violence costs? How about increasing the fine on those guilty of domestic violence? Instead of charging every couple that get married as though they're part of the problem, why don't you charge everybody who's found guilty of domestic violence $500 instead? I looked up the statistics. About 20% of all couples, married or not, end up engaging in some kind of domestic violence. That's one person in five. Don't charge the people getting married an extra $100. Charge the domestic abusers, male or female, charge them an extra $500 and dedicate that money to domestic violence. Today's best email, but you can always send more. It's brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. Believe me, I've had them do it for me. It is a beautiful result. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. John writes in, Lars, as a motorcycle enthusiast and daily rider, I'm appalled at the surface conditions on Interstate 5 between Tukwila and downtown Seattle. Lars, there are a number of potholes so deep on Interstate 5, the rebar is actually exposed. Now, imagine if you hit rebar on a motorcycle at 60 miles an hour and you have a blowout. To say the least, the scene would not be pretty. There needs to be a concerted effort to improve the road surfaces on I-5. After all, don't we pay the highest gas taxes in the country? It really comes down to a matter of safety. And wouldn't it be nice if they would smooth out the bumpiness, I guess, they're wearing on the body, going over the bumps through the ride and stuff? I know I get off my motorcycle and I feel exhausted. Signed, John. Very good point, John. I'll take the suggestion. Let's start out with let's go to Mike in Cloverdale. Hey, Mike, welcome to Monday on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Yes, Lars. I have to say I agree 100% with everything you talked about, but I don't understand a lot of things. I'm a very poor man. I'm very successful for only making $20,000 a year. But, you know, I don't understand why our taxes have to be so high when we have the richest states in this country with lumber that can be used. And why are we hiding that? Why are we trying to keep it? It's kind of like our farms. It's there to be used to feed us. And why? And your domestic violence you just talked about.
Well, don't leave that first subject because we're going to be close to the break. But, Mike, I'm with you. I've been arguing for close to 30 years that we ought to take the federal forests and the state forests and the private forests and log them aggressively. Log every single tree you can cut as long as you stay at sustained yield, where you can cut that number of trees and never run out of trees because they grow faster than you're cutting them. We should be cutting federal lands about five times as fast as we are. It also reduces the risk of fires, and that will save us a lot of money as well. Mike, I've been arguing for that for years. Donald Trump has now said he will increase the amount of logging we do in federal forests. We should do the same at the state level, too.
The Lars Larson Show. The work so you don't have to. Bringing the political heat. He's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails, and we got a lot to talk about, including how the University of Washington was taking part in an experiment on how to dim the sun, except, no, not dim some like the Chinese dish or Chinese food style, but dimming the sun. And the University of Washington was involved in it. but they weren't going to tell the public what they were doing out of fear that they would scare the public by telling them we're trying to experiment with ways to make the sun's light not have as much effect on planet Earth, but don't tell anybody what we're doing. That would simply scare them unnecessarily. I also want to talk about how Governor Kotek has now backed down six different times since she took office on her major priorities. Apparently, that's what counts as leadership when you're the corruptly elected governor of the state of Washington. But first, I want to go to Steve in the Dalles. Hey, Steve, welcome to a Monday on the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind? Steve? And I thought Steve was going to have something to say, but apparently he does not have anything to say. Well, Steve, thanks very much. Hey, let me get back to the details on this, about what the university was doing. This happened in an experiment that was done last year. We've learned more about it today. Led by the University of Washington, they were intending to run this experiment for months. It lasted for about 20 minutes. They were actually doing the experiment not in Seattle, where the University of Washington is located. They were doing it in Alameda, California, and they didn't tell the public what they were planning to do. So the researchers had talked to donors because they figured we're not going to get federal money for this kind of craziness. So they got a bunch of rich people, billionaires, to put up a bunch of money. And what they wanted to do was create a set of clouds over a stretch of ocean, and the clouds they were going to create were going to be larger than Puerto Rico. Now, I know that some of you were a bit skeptical when people expressed some concerns that those massive, deadly floods that happened in Texas not so long ago, the ones that took the lives of dozens of little girls who were at a church camp because the Guadalupe River rose so fast, they said, people aren't out there trying to change the weather. Well, consider this report. Hundreds of documents now show how researchers failed to notify officials in California about a test of a new technology to block the sun's rays, and they had planned a much bigger experiment if this one worked well. A team of researchers in California drew notoriety last year, we talked about it at that time, with an aborted experiment on a retired aircraft carrier in Alameda, California. That's a former big naval base just across the bay from San Francisco. They were testing out a machine for creating clouds. Behind the scenes, they were planning a much larger and potentially even riskier study of saltwater spraying equipment that would eventually be used to dim the light of the sun. This is all from Politico. Researchers quietly tested the plan, but they said, we don't want to scare the public, so we're going to simply keep the public in the dark about our plans to make the sun go just a little bit darker, at least the amount of sunlight that is reaching planet Earth. The city of Alameda saw what was going on. They went in and they deliberately said, shut this thing down. It shut down after about 20 minutes. They had been planning to do this for several months to try to put enough water in the air to create fake clouds. The initial test was meant to be a sequel. Before that began, the researchers were talking to donors about conducting a test to try to create almost 4,000 square miles of clouds off the west coast of North America, Chile, or South Central Africa. According to 400 documents, they were obtained by Politico and by what's known as E&E News. So, in other words, we talked about what had happened last year. We talked about the fact that they ran this experiment, but then E&E managed to get some of the open records out of the University of Washington. And thank goodness, University of Washington is a public institution. So private institutions probably could have kept this entirely private. Because it was a public institution, they're required to respond to open records requests. And as a result, they were shut down. They were apparently planning to say, it's getting too warm on planet Earth, so let's just block out the sun for a period of time. And then let me update you on this. Oregon Catalyst and the Taxpayers Association have now documented the six different times that Governor Tina Kotek has backed down from what she was calling some of her top priorities. Now, let me make the point. I don't think there's a problem if somebody says, well, this thing I was going to do turns out to be a really bad idea, so I think what I'll do is I'll change course. I'm not going to fault a politician for doing that. But as they point out, Tina Kotek has now backtracked on new farm stand rules. Those are the ones I mentioned in the commentary that we're going to do a job on farm owners in Oregon. Her agency, the Department of Land Conservation and Development, came up with a bad rule for farms that included big new permit requirements and fees. It would limit farm stands to only sell the products that came from their own farm. You couldn't even sell products that were made by your neighbor's farms. It would make it very difficult for farms to host weddings or concerts. The result was that farmers realized the place they were getting a bit of extra income to be able to make farming economical was going to suddenly go away. But let me tell you some of the other things that Tina Kotek has backed down on. For example, the legislature just finished in late June, right before July, the legislature wrapped up and did not pass, thank goodness, a $15 billion increase in taxes to fund the Oregon Department of Transportation. That department is so seriously flawed. They have made multi-billion dollar errors. They continue to push projects that they do not have the funding for. And then they turn around and say, well, we're already halfway into this. You've got to fund the rest of this. That kind of extortionist behavior by a government department should be shut down. Governor Kotek even went to the lawmakers after keeping largely silent during the legislative session and at the last minute said, we'll at least give them $2 billion. That failed as well. And now she's calling for a special session at the end of August. And at the end of August, she will propose a number of increases in taxes intended to fund a failed government agency known as ODOT. Then she backtracked on theft of the kicker. Back in May of this year, almost 3 months ago, Governor Kotek came out and said, we're going to take away the people's income tax refund to pay for wildfire costs. Well, there was a big public backlash to that, and she ended up backtracking, saying, no, we're only going to take it away from the upper income earners. Everybody else gets to keep their kicker. That was a major backdown, and thank God for it. She also backtracked on another story that we talked about on this show, and that is there was a woman who stole. She embezzled over $100,000 from a newspaper in Eugene, the Eugene Weekly newspaper. She very nearly put that newspaper out of business. Then she fled the state. When the police finally caught up with her in Ohio, Governor Kotek was asked, do you want to extradite her to face the music back in Oregon? She said no. And now she has backtracked on that. Again, she has always taken the wrong position. And then when there's enough public pressure, she takes the right position. And then even her own Democrat Party, which controls supermajorities in the House and the Senate, they actually steamrolled right over her because a foster care regulation bill was going to be vetoed by the governor. They said, nope, you're not going to veto it. It is the first time that the legislature has overturned a veto since 2011, almost 15 years ago. And then, of course, her number one priority was supposed to be housing. She had proposed a nearly $900 million plan. Lawmakers said, nope, we'll give you a quarter of that amount. So it turns out that her number one priority is not going to get the funding that Tina Kotek was looking for. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.
Small town politics with big town opinions. This is the Lars Larson Show. Try that in a
small town. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Boy, is there a story cooking out there, and it's only popped up in the last hour or two. It's about a gay couple. And one of the people in that couple, this couple became well known because their story was going viral on X, you know, the social media platform, because they were talking about creating a child through surrogacy. That raises all kinds of ethical problems to begin with. But these two men wanted to have a baby. And so they wanted to, they basically went out and contracted with a woman to bear their surrogate child. So she did that. They now have the baby. They popularized all of this online. And of course, they funded the cost of it through crowdfunding. Well, guess what? Brandon Keith Riley Mitchell is one of the two men in the couple, and he is a convicted child sex offender, and he is also a registered sex offender. That means his sex offenses were serious enough that the law requires that he regularly register as a sex offender. So, reported by a number of social media sites, and I checked, the story is breaking throughout the mainstream media. It's been revealed that a gay couple who crowdfunded their surrogacy journey to go out and pay somebody to create a baby for them, even though the two of them could not have produced a baby on their own, despite one partner being a convicted child sex offender using a Pennsylvania surrogacy loophole that bypasses state adoption restrictions on registered predators. So, it almost suggests an ex-poll question for us for tomorrow. And that is, if you're a registered sex offender, should you ever be able to adopt a child? Sounds like most states have a rule against that. Should you, if you can't adopt a child, be able to go out and contract with a woman to buy a child? Well, he was allowed to do that. It's going to be interesting to see how the mainstream media handles that one. It will make them uncomfortable, I would imagine, in a whole bunch of different ways, because you've got a child sex offender who's then allowed to create a baby. And Pennsylvania had the sense to put it in the law and say, if you're a registered sex offender, you can't go out and adopt a child. Well, fine. Then I'll just go out and buy one instead, seems to be the answer. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. This segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. And a lot of emails. John writes in, Lars, so the environmental whack jobs in Seattle are proposing or protesting the Blue Angels, saying Seattle needs to ban them because they cause global warming. A sad world we live in, signed John Merrill. John, I think you're absolutely right. I mentioned the story on Friday. This group was actually, they were so angry about the Navy Blue Angels coming for the air show in Seattle that they actually bought a billboard. You pay for a billboard, and the billboard message is that the Blue Angels are too loud, and that, of course, they cause global warming because they're jets and they burn fuel. That's the kind of attitude there is, that in the city of Seattle, a city that is identified, by the way, with the air travel business, primarily Boeing makes passenger jets, but they also make military equipment as well. And you're literally going to object to the Navy Blue Angels visiting Seattle because they cause global warming? Yeah, you're right. It is a truly sad world. And then Ed writes in about the story I mentioned, University of Washington being involved in that experiment about creating cloud banks artificially to block out the light of the sun. Ed writes, Lars, this really shows how stupid these people are. They need to get on the same page. First, they demand solar power, and then these mental midgets want to block out the sun. I don't get it. And Michael wrote in with an interesting question, although sadly there's not a great answer to it. If, according to you and the Washington Policy Center, our state's politicians have lied and failed to correctly allocate taxes from the Climate Commitment Act, that's Jay Inslee's carbon tax, then why not hold those accountable? If new taxes were to go instead to public safety, but went instead for studies to enlarge the government and people's lives were lost, then who would be held accountable? And the answer is, number one, the Climate Commitment Act was, as we pointed out from the beginning, and Todd Myers amplified this, that when they passed the Climate Commitment Act to put a carbon tax on every kind of fuel that involves carbon, that's natural gas, propane, diesel, and gasoline, that when they collect that, we pointed out from the beginning, when it was first conceived of by Jay Inslee, that it was a giant slush fund. The money was not guaranteed to go to any one cause at all. It was simply money that Olympia, in this case, could spend on anything they think is right. So an awful lot of it went to pay for government bureaucracy. And is there a way to hold those people accountable? other than to vote for the other person when it comes to the, you know, the final decision in at election time next year. The only way to get any kind of change is either public pressure, and that's tough, or vote for the other person when the next election comes up. And Cody writes in about our ex-poll question today. Lars, wow, hard to believe you're in favor of Trump letting his good friend Ghislaine Maxwell go for a paltry five names. Any good prosecutor would ask for at least 20. What we've asked you is, if Ghislaine Maxwell can name five of the perverts that she supplied with children for sex and they get prosecuted or at least indicted, would you give her a pardon in exchange for that? I'd say five, taking five real child predators off the streets, I think it'd be well worth it in that case. Glad to be with you on a Monday. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. Lars. And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. I'm glad to get you your phone calls and emails, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you're a naysayer, I'll put you right to the head of the list. We always have, we always will, because we love naysayers on this program. If you want to send an email, it's talk@LarsLarson.com. And then again, you've got our ex-poll question today. I decided to make it a bit challenging. It has to do with Ghislaine Maxwell. She is the convicted human trafficker who created the opportunity for the late Jeffrey Epstein, who either killed himself or got murdered, depending on your point of view. He had been convicted previously of using girls for sex, and Ghislaine Maxwell was involved in creating that opportunity, in providing his victims to him. He was on his way to being convicted, I think, a second time when he died in custody, a bit mysteriously, and I think not by suicide, but probably by murder. Well, now you've got Ghislaine Maxwell, who's talking to the Congress and saying that she has information that they might want to hear. So I think it's very clear that what she's seeking, or lawyers are asking the Supreme Court to throw out her conviction altogether. But so she may run the clock out there. But she's also apparently seeking a presidential pardon. Now, President Trump and Ghislaine Maxwell had in the past been at least acquaintances, if not friends. Would you trade a Ghislaine Maxwell pardon to her for prosecuting the perverts she identifies? And I explained to you that, you know, we certainly see lots of cases where people get a lesser sentence in exchange for testifying against a bigger fish that the prosecutor may be pursuing. I thought I'd put that first to our friend Josh Marquis, the former district attorney. Hey, Josh, before I get to another subject I want to throw at you at the last minute, tell me what you make of this. If Ghislaine Maxwell could actually identify, let's say, five people who were provided with children for sexual purposes, truly evil stuff, who are still out there running around loose and unindicted, unconvicted, if she can provide the information that brings about their indictments, would that be enough to grant her a pardon?
It should not. Absolutely not. She was one of the primary movers. And clearly, as you said in your intro, it's very unclear as to whether Jeffrey Epstein was murdered by whoever or committed suicide. But nonetheless, Maxwell was in on this. She was, you know, the grand dam, literally, and she was running it. She never testified on her own defense. She was found guilty. There is no legitimate reason for, quote, making a deal with someone who has no reason. There's no reason to believe anything she says. Let's assume that she does, which she probably does, have some really remarkable information about some high prominent official, either Republican or Democrat, which is entirely possible. Why would we believe her? Because at this point, she's lied about everything, and the only reason that they would be doing this would be basically to make more deals. And I think many Americans are deeply, deeply suspicious of cases that where there's a trial and then a president or a governor steps in and says, oh, I'm going to pardon everybody. Now, Democrats have been grand masters at that, particularly here in Oregon and in other places. But Trump has been doing it, too. And I believe it's fundamentally wrong. We're not going to find out what happened.
Well, the only reason I put the criteria in there that it would have to lead to an indictment is that if she were to name five people and say these right. were five people who ended up with sex with children, you know, because I supplied them or Jeffrey Epstein directed right. that I supply them, it would have to actually lead to an indictment. And her word alone would not be sufficient. There'd have to be other evidence before
absolutely.
You'd ever bring an indictment of those people. Right.
And it's yes, absolutely. And it's very likely, considering that she's already been convicted of being not just incidental, but a principal in it, that the judge might, as a matter of law in a federal case, and I have tried cases like this, rule that her testimony alone is insufficient and that basically the jury should disbelieve it. And even if the judge didn't tell them that, the jury probably would say, why should we believe a single word she says?
Yeah, because the defense attorney would stand up and say, you can't believe this woman. She lied for a living. She provided children to Jeffrey Epstein for sex. That is a conviction. I mean, we already know she did that. So therefore, let me ask you about another issue. And this is just now breaking. Although I have a feeling the mainstream media is going to have a tough time dealing with this one. There is a gay couple, and this gay couple decided that they wanted to have a child. This is two men, and they went online, and they did a crowdfunding to cover the costs of creating a surrogate child, which I think is problematic to begin with, as though you can go out and buy a child. You hire a woman, you have her implanted with sperm and egg and an embryo, and then you create a child and you own the child because you paid for it. I find all of that disgusting and
well,
wrong.
Nobody owns a child. That's
except that when you can
you
go out
control,
and cause...
As the parents, you have control over
I understand that, but when you go out and as a result of you ordering up a child, you can commission a surrogate. Legal in
you're
most
right,
places.
Lars. Yeah,
America.
No, the idea of, you know, you want that somebody can say, oh, I want a particular race, I want a particular color, I want a particular, you know, sexual gender, and I want them to, you know, have, you know, it's we're getting into an area of eugenics, I think, that most of us find repellent.
Yeah, it's disgusting. Now, here's the thing. In most states, and I double-checked this morning, this is only being reported by Redux, which is a feminist website, and they're saying it turns out that one of the two men is a convicted sex offender and convicted of a serious enough offense that he's required to register as a sex offender. In Pennsylvania, wow. where this couple is, you can't adopt for all intents and purposes. And most states have regulations that while there's not an explicit ban on registered sex offenders adopting, sure. that they put you through a background check and say, no, we're not going to approve it. But there is
because
no such limit.
Has been shown to abuse children.
Yes. And now you've ordered up a child. Well, they crowdfunded this thing, and now it turns out one is a registered sex offender. According to the Chester County DA's office, they say this guy was teaching at a school. He convinced a student at the school who was about half his age, 16, to do various things for him, sent the kid nude pictures and did other disgusting stuff. Should there be a limitation on being able to order up a surrogate child if you're a registered sex offender?
Absolutely. I mean, people can get married or people can adopt, but when it is not the matter of a marriage or a traditional relationship, which in some circumstances could, I suppose, include gay couples, when you're talking about actually adopting, the state has a legitimate right to say, what's this person's background? And the idea that you would, and again, it really wouldn't matter whether this person had a sex offense for a gay crime or a heterosexual crime, I think society is legitimate in saying, I'm sorry, you have shown your gross irresponsibility that you don't care about children and in the fact that you're willing to ruin them. And so we're not going to sanction you by granting you a license, essentially, because that's what an adoption is.
That's what it is. It's a license to go out and adopt a child, and we're not going to give that license to people who are convicted sex offenders. Hey, Josh, thanks for the call. Back in a moment. You got the Lars Larson Show.
unwrapping the news so you don't have to. Back to the Lars Larson Show.
Now, you hear that? That was what was going on Sunday, because a man went on a stabbing spree at Walmart in Traverse City, Michigan. Now, what happened? 11 people were badly hurt, 6 of them critical, 3 of them required surgery after this stabbing attack last night in Traverse City, Michigan. And what stopped it? Well, you wouldn't know it from listening to the governor of that state, because she praised the first responders. And without any due disrespect to the police, when seconds count, the police are usually only minutes away. And in this case, in Traverse City, Michigan, at the Walmart, when the man began his stabbing spree, he was finally stopped by a good guy with a gun. And by the way, we've come to find out not just a good guy with a gun, but a Marine veteran by the name of Derek Perry, who pulled out his pistol, pointed at the guy, and despite all the wild imaginings of the liberal left, they think that when you have a gun and carry a gun and have a carry permit, you're doing it legally, and you use it to protect yourself and others, you're just going to start firing rounds downrange. That's not what he did. He pointed the gun. He told the guy to drop the weapon. The man was then subdued by people in the area nearby, and then the police responded. Subdued by bystanders at the store, the Grand Traverse County Sheriff Michael Shea announced what happened yesterday, last night, because he was talking about this awful incident. Now, what do we know about the incentive or the motivation behind this man's terrible attack on these people, sending 11 people to the hospital, 6 in critical condition, 3 of them taking surgery? We don't know anything at all. He could be just the garden variety crazy man that seems to populate almost every city. And by the way, Traverse City, not a big city, about 17,000 people in the city, about 150,000 people in the area immediately around Traverse City. It's a relatively small town, but this knife-wielding maniac, and he went in there with a folding knife, just a pocket knife, and began stabbing people for reasons we don't understand yet. But a good guy with a gun stopped him. And it's my time, or this, I'll take this opportunity to remind you, the FBI and the DOJ have done studies on this. They say that kind of action by a good guy or good gal with a gun happens about 1.5 million times every year in the United States of America. When somebody uses a firearm to stop a crime from happening that's already in effect, or to stop one from that's about to happen. A young lady who finds herself maybe confronted by somebody who's threatening her, she pulls out a gun and the bad guy goes away. And are shots fired? Not very often at all. As in this case, no shots fired, bad guy stopped, good result. And what happens? The governor of the state of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, who as far as I'm concerned is kind of a crook anyway, but she comes out and she says, well, I'm in touch with law enforcement about the horrible news out of Traverse City. Our thoughts are with the victims. The community is reeling. I am grateful to the first responders for their swift response to apprehend the suspect. Well, as I said, no disrespect to the cops, but Governor Whitmer is wrong. It was not the police who apprehended the suspect. It was good guy with a gun and other people at the store. The police came and then took the man into custody. At that point, that's what happened. But he had already been stopped by people who are doing the right thing there at the Walmart in Michigan. To your calls now at 866-HEY-LARS. Let me start with a naysayer, and that's Gordon. Hey, Gordon, you know how much we love naysayers on this program. So welcome to the program. Thanks for calling. What do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
I still think the electric ferries is worth the investment in Edmonds area in Washington, because I've sailed out there, and I think that there's new they gotta show more numbers on this stuff. And
no, hold on, Gordon, why would you care what powers a boat anywhere in America? If the best kind of fuel, if the best kind of fuel is electric, great. If it's diesel, great. If it's propane or natural gas, great. If it's gasoline, great. If it's wind, great. Why do you think that electric ferries are superior in any way whatsoever? Because they cost a lot more money than the alternative. Why is it worth the money to buy electric ferry boats?
I think it's just the propellers are going to retract and come back, and you're talking.
Okay, Gordon, you're not making any sense, but I very much appreciate the call. Let's go to Darren. Hey, Darren, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. It's a great, beautiful day in the Pacific Northwest, and thank God for people like Derek Perry who are willing to conceal carry, just like myself and my brothers. We all conceal carry. And I guarantee you the governor of our state of Oregon would not come out and congratulate us if we did the same thing. But I did not call you about that. I called you about the gay couple in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And I've known a few people, unfortunately, that have been on, you know, have been required to report as sexual deviants. And it seems to me that one of the stipulations in there is you cannot be around a minor if your offense was against a minor. Isn't just planning to be around a minor, and you know, it shouldn't matter if you're creating your own life. It's still a life, and it's still a minor. It seems to me that the powers that be in Pennsylvania should be looking at this gentleman and possibly having a few words with him, if not giving him a couple new bracelets to wear on his way.
I think you're right, Darren, because That state in particular, but almost every state has limitations on who's allowed to adopt. So if you have a rule that says you can't adopt a child if you're a registered sex offender, and that's what Pennsylvania has. Most other states, none of the states has an absolute limitation. It may be that, you know, somebody who's a registered sex offender might clear through if they say, I've changed my life, I've changed my behavior, I've done this, that, and the other thing. But they make it deliberately difficult for anybody who's a registered sex offender to adopt a child. If you can't adopt a child, why should you be able to go out and take enough money and hire somebody to make a child for you? To buy a child, and that's what it is. It's buying a child.
It's a definition of, is adoption, does that fall under surrogacy and creating your own life?
Nope, apparently not.
I would argue that it could be.
It should.
Somebody needs to look at them. Let's put it that way.
Well, I agree with you, because here's the thing. If you have got two gay guys, they're still missing some ingredients to make an embryo, aren't they? Without getting into the nasty details, you don't have what it takes to make an embryo. So you have to get an embryo from somewhere else and have it created and then have it implanted in somebody. And then when that child is born, I honestly don't know whether you're technically adopting a child that's created by a surrogate mother. I assume you have some kind of contract with her that says, we will pay you this much money. You will be made pregnant, probably by artificial, you know, either implanting of an embryo or some other artificial insemination. I mean, the whole thing sounds horrible in that you're creating children the way a farmer or a rancher creates, you know, sheep and lambs and calves. So,
look at it this way too, Lars. It is, you know, adoption agencies charge a great deal of money to put you up in front of the line, to do a lot of investigation around you, make sure you're a proper parent, to be able to put a child in your home. Isn't that the same thing that these gentlemen are doing?
I would think it is the same thing, unless the private agency that put them in charge or in touch with the surrogate mother, unless they just ignored it because the money was too attractive. I think the mainstream media is going to avoid this.
The Lars Larson Show. You can literally have Lars with you all day, every day. Podcasts at Spotify, Apple, SoundCloud, and live right now. What a time to be alive. Here's Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I want to talk about some of the cutoff of funding from the United States government to NPR and PBS. Now, NPR and PBS funded through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I've spoken out against that for more than 25 years. I've questioned, why would a free country with a free media, and by the way, abundant media these days, much more so than perhaps decades ago, but we've got, you know, social media, we've got private streaming, we've got, you know, cable news channels and everything else. Why we would need to have government-funded media, I don't know. But thank God now it's being cut off thanks to the Congress and thanks to the big, beautiful bill and Donald Trump. I wanted to talk to Joe Vasquez about it, who's associate editor at MRC Business, the Media Research Center. Joseph, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Lars, good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it turns out that not only were we funding NPR and PBS, but it turns out we were also funding a very left-leaning organization involved in so-called fact-checking. Would you mind telling my audience about that?
Even that is a bit of a euphemism. This particular organization called the Poynter Institute for Media Studies runs the infamous International Fact-Checking Network, which was partnered with big tech platforms like Facebook and Instagram and also TikTok to censor conservative viewpoints on COVID-19, climate change, abortion, election security, you name it. You get one of the fact checkers from that whole web plastered on one of your posts, your reach goes down, your account gets suspended, all because of what this organization was doing. And it turns out that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is fully funded by the federal government, which is ironic to me because they make it seem like that they're a private corporation. I'm like, look, if you're getting full funding from the federal government, you are not separate from the federal government. You're an arm of the federal government. And they were giving tax money, at least a $600,000 grant in 2023, to Poynter, which to me is just like, it screams conflict of interest because apparently there is a partnership going on between Poynter and the CPB to help member radio stations vis-a-vis NPR and others to expand their digital reach online, which is ironic because on the other end, Poynter's IFCN was working with big tech platforms to censor speech online. So tell me if that's a good use of taxpayer dollars. I would think that your listeners do not think so.
I mean, because look, I understand, Joe, when people like you at Media Research or me in what I've done over the years, when we run a story that runs counter to the narrative you're getting out of government, whether government is local government or national government, they find that inconvenient. Well, we're telling the public this and the media is telling them something else. I think that's a healthy situation when private media, not funded by the government, tells the public, well, the government may be telling you this is a good idea. We're going to tell you why it's a bad idea. Or the government may be telling you this thing has solved the problem of whatever the problem is, global warming, educating children, whatever it is. And we're telling you it's not as they say. That's healthy. When you have the government saying, we're going to tell you how it is, and the public says, well, I'm not sure I can trust you. I think I'll turn on PBS or NPR, or I'll check with the International Fact-Checking Network, and you say, wow, all of them are saying the same thing because they're all paid for out of the same treasury. That shouldn't surprise anybody at all.
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, they'll tell you, but if we don't have public media, it's a threat to democracy. I'm like, are you kidding me? You are a propaganda mouthpiece for the federal government. Hello. And you know what's even more incestuous about this whole thing? You're talking about NPR and PBS. It turns out that the senior vice president for Poynter, Kelly McBride, also serves as NPR's public editor. Need I say more? It's a whole incestuous relationship between Poynter, between NPR, and the CPB. Thank God the rescission package went through, because I mean, I would be darned if my tax dollars are not only funding liberal sewage that gets spewed on the airwaves, but on the back end, I'm paying an organization to then censor my viewpoints online. Get out of here.
By the way, I have to thank Joe Vasquez because you might not have noticed what he did, but he did a soft correction of me because I had said it was the big, beautiful bill. It was, in fact, the almost $10 billion rescission package. Two different pieces of legislation. I'm sure, Joe, somebody would have said, Lars, you said it was the OBBB when, in fact, it was the big rescission package instead. You're right. But that's what finally cut it out. And why we let this thing go on so long. So what's the reaction going to be? Are the big billionaires like George Soros that have backed up Poynter and other organizations like it, are they going to make up the money or what?
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, the fact that this organization even got money from the CPB, even though it was notorious for receiving money from Soros, who funded the IFCN directly, including his counterpart, I mean his partner, eBay co-founder Pierre Omidyar, who also funds a lot of these censorship initiatives. That should have been the first major red flag. They're just the first major red flag of conflict of interest. But guess what? If NPR is able to get money from these groups before, they can do it again. Guess what? Welcome to the free market, where you can actually get people who agree with you to provide your financing. Just like the Media Research Center, we're a nonprofit organization. We have to make our case to the American people that, you know, that the work we're doing means something. You know, we don't get, you know, like we don't get grants from the CPB like NPR does. They could put garbage on their website about how the trans community had the dino emoji stolen from them, and we're subsidizing that with our tax dollars, and they get paid regardless. But, you know, but for the rest of us in this field, we actually have to work for a living. So welcome to the free market, gents.
Well, and not only that, but you have to take responsibility for that piece of it, too, because the Soros wants to give his money to, say, he wants to make up the, or the Tides Foundation decides to make up the lost money over at PBS and NPR. They've got to live with the relationship that comes with that money. And he has to live with whatever that it is they do with it. And if there are strings going one way or the other, if Soros says, I'll give you all this money, but then you're going to do the kind of news stories I want you to do, and you're going to avoid the kind of news stories I want you to avoid, then PBS and NPR have to make a decision. If you're going to take the money, are you going to go, is it going to come with strings? And if it comes with strings, is your audience going to know, yeah, we're reporting on this, but because this is what the left would say. If instead of, say, Bezos buying the Washington Post, if it had been BP or Shell Oil, I mean, the left would never let you forget that a newspaper was owned by an oil company or a chemical company or some other concern. Are they going to do the same when it comes to big donations from very politically oriented people like George Soros?
I got the perfect response to that. CBS News ran a documentary smearing billionaires vis-a-vis Elon Musk for his involvement in the 2024 election. And one of the people that CBS interviewed to decree these billionaires getting involved in politics was a reporter from get this, Bloomberg News. Who owns Bloomberg News?
Michael Bloomberg, who's a billionaire.
Exactly.
So there are good, yeah, I guess there are good billionaires. And they're bad billionaires. And the thing that makes the difference between the good ones and the bad ones are the good ones writing us checks? And as long as they write us checks, then they're the good billionaires. And it's only the ones that aren't writing us checks that are the bad billionaires, right?
You hit the nail right on the head. It doesn't, like, you know, if you're a billionaire funding the wrong politics, oh, you're a threat to democracy. But if you're Michael Bloomberg, who literally owns one of the biggest media empires in the world, oh yeah, he's part of the mainstream. We can take his media thing as credible. Even though during the 2020 election, when Michael Bloomberg stepped away so that he could pay $1 billion towards his own campaign, his own news outlet said that they weren't going to investigate him. No one made a big stink about that one, but no, Bezos dares to say that the opinion section of his lefty newspaper is going to go in a free market direction. Oh, then everybody loses their minds about bias. Get over yourself.
No kidding. And there is a word for the kind of business where you agree to get in bed with somebody for the right amount of money, and that appears to be what PBS and NPR right now. Yep, just live with it. That's what you decided to do. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. We all feel it.
He's up before you are. Weeding out the right from the wrong. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. And this segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Let me jump right to Tracy. Tracy, you called in about a story that I think is just now beginning to emerge. I'm curious whether the mainstream, the cartel media, actually does much with this, but the short version, just so people know what you're referencing, a gay couple that went online, they decided to do what's called crowdfunding because they wanted to create a surrogate child. And then the child has been born, and they raise the money to make it happen because it's not an inexpensive process to pay the surrogate, to pay for artificial insemination or a implantation of an embryo, all the rest of that, which I think raises a whole host of moral issues, but that's for another day. And then we find out that one of the men in the gay couple is a registered sex offender, with his interest aimed at young boys. And you say, well, should he be should he be able to go out and basically create or order the creation of a child? I think the easy answer to that is no. I think the mainstream media is going to look at that and say, we don't even want to touch that story because of all the implications it raises. What's your take on it?
Well, my take is exactly the same as yours, and I'm perplexed on how it could even come about. I have a very, very good friend, lifelong friend, that lives in California. Her and her husband were unable to conceive and carry a child, and they went the surrogate route with a gestational carrier. So baby's embryo created, both parents were involved with the creation of this embryo. It is their biological child being carried by a surrogate. At the time that surrogate gave birth, she didn't really have any rights to keep the child, but she could have protested the transfer of the child. And this couple who and still are the biological parents of this child had to go through an adoption process, even though the child was biologically theirs. So I'm confused on how that wouldn't be the case in other states.
I can tell you this, Tracy, because this popped up literally after I was already on the air today, I've done a little bit of research. There is no one set of rules because we have 50 states and the rules are different in all 50. But I looked into whether or not you have to legally adopt a child born via surrogacy. And they said not always, which is one of those great answers that keeps the lawyers employed. But they said if you follow the correct legal procedures to establish parentage before the child is conceived or born, then you may not even have to adopt them. Which, and for all we know, they haven't gotten into the nitty-gritty details. I haven't followed. The first I heard of this story was when I saw that this Redux, which is a feminist website, a news site, where they look at these kinds of stories. They said, so we don't know if one of these two men is the biological father of the child, which would still make him the biological father, even if the mother was this surrogate that they hired. And the second thing is, when it comes to surrogacy, I haven't spent a lot of time on that over the years. It's come up from time to time. But if you go out and you hire a young lady and you say, this is our deal. You will get paid this amount of money. Your job is to carry the child. And when the child is born, you'll give the child up. If she takes the money and signs the contract, could she contest that? Yeah, probably. Could she beat the contract that she signed? I would guess probably not. She could tie it up in knots for a while. But whether or not so let's say one of the two men, and we don't know if it's the registered sex offender or the other one. The other one apparently has a clean record, as near as I can tell. If he's the biological father of the child, it may be that they don't even need to formally adopt it because the two of them are married. The one father is the biological father of the child, and the surrogate mother has given up her rights in advance. Does that make sense?
Yeah, like you said, it must be based by state because my friends who are the biological parents of their child had to legally adopt him in the state of California after he was born and given over to them. Yep.
And I would expect that California, if there's a state that I had to guess had more stringent rules, regulations, and procedures, it would be California. Now, in Pennsylvania, sure. Apparently, you are not allowed to adopt a child in most cases, in most states, if you are a registered sex offender. And apparently, there are some opportunities that if you went through a bunch of screening and a bunch of background and maybe clear all these hurdles, but most people who are registered sex offenders are not allowed to adopt a child. But because surrogacy is different than adopting, I think it raises a whole host of issues that probably ought to be dealt with by either the Congress or by the individual states. In fact, I'd almost rather it was by the Congress. So there's one set of rules that says this is how it's going to be. But I suspect under the Constitution, it may actually fall to the states because they may say this is something in which the federal government does not have a role, even though the rights of that child as a human being should be protected by federal law, shouldn't they? No matter where the child lives?
Absolutely. You and I are in agreement for that.
Yeah. And so then this question comes up. Will the mainstream media look at this? Because they tend to take most cases that would make lesbian, gay, bisexual, or trans look bad. And they tend to bury those stories as deep as they can, as soon as they can, the minute they realize it. So I'm wondering how much the cartel media is even going to cover this mess. And it does sound like a mess. Will they have the state of Pennsylvania walk in and say, you have no right to have that child in your household. You are a registered sex offender. Or will they simply ignore it as being a political hot potato and a governor of Pennsylvania who I think plans to run for president?
The Lars Larson Show.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You know, in this case, I actually do like saying, I told you so. Or if I was more honest than that, to say that Todd Myers told you that it was going to be this way. Todd is the vice president for research at Washington Policy Center. And what this has to do with is about $4 billion, which in Washington, D.C. is kind of a rounding error. It's a very small amount. But for the state of Washington, it's a large amount of money. And where's that $4 billion coming from? It's coming from the Climate Commitment Act, which essentially every single person in the state is paying, whether you know it or not. It is a carbon tax on everything that uses carbon. So gasoline, diesel, propane, natural gas, the whole Marianne. And as a result, you end up paying it. You say, but I don't have a car. I have a bicycle. Doesn't matter. How do you think that bicycle got to the store where you bought it? How do you think your food gets to the store or any other goods that you buy? They all come by means of something that is usually driven by some kind of fuel. Well, now the taxpayers are paying this, even though it's not labeled as a tax. And then the question comes, where's the $4 billion going? Well, the guy who knows that best is Todd Myers. Todd, welcome back to the program. Tell my audience, is all of that $4 billion going to things that make climate Earth safer from climate change?
Unfortunately, even if you wanted it to, it's not. In fact, a lot of it is going to very frivolous places. It basically goes into three buckets. One, transportation, and not transportation projects like road construction, but transportation projects like transit and bike lanes. And then the second is various different projects of, you know, sometimes questionable merit. But the one I looked at most recently is in the state operating budget for the next 2 years, where the money is going. And what we found is that about 70% of the money is going just to expand government, hire more government bureaucrats, do more government planning, things that won't have any impact or benefit to the environment at all.
Well, and in fact, I would argue that to some extent, state government tends to have a bad effect on the environment. But what are they? Who are they hiring with all these dollars that they say are going to lead to us getting a better environment?
Well, let me give you just two examples. One is that the state, in its wisdom, has required local governments to include climate change in their growth management planning. The Growth Management Act has many different goals, and so they added, you know, yet another goal to make this planning more complicated. But to help them, the state is sending $22.5 million to local governments to do that planning. What do we get from that? Do we get environmental benefit? No, we get more shell fart. We get more process. We get more bureaucracy. And in fact, the complaint is that the Growth Management Act already isn't achieving the goals that it has and is wasting money. Let me give you one more example. Even things that sound good, like reducing flooding, end up just going into more government. There's about $4 million to reduce flooding in the Nooksack, which is up toward the Canadian border in Washington State. But virtually all of that goes to more staff, more process, to do collaboration, to work with local governments. None of that $4 million actually goes into projects on the ground that reduce flooding.
So in other words, they could, I realized $4 million or $20 million probably would not build much in the way of flood control dams and things like that. But in this case, all they're doing is hiring more people who will sit down and write reports saying we ought to do this or we ought to do that. And some of it seems to be predicated on the thought that the climate is changing and that it is inevitable, and that we have to prepare for its effects. So it's not even trying to address whether or not the climate is changed by CO2. I don't believe that it is. I believe CO2 is an effect of the climate change, but not the thing that is driving it. But even if it were, all you're doing is saying we're going to have some more personnel who will coordinate among various governments, talking about all the things they ought to do in anticipation of, say, more spring runoff or things that have been going on in the Northwest for hundreds of years.
That's exactly right. And just let me give you an example. Forest fires, right? Whether you believe that forest fires are caused by climate change or whether they're caused by unhealthy forests, I think the evidence is very clear that unhealthy forests are the primary driver of a lot of the forest fires that I've been seeing. But whatever the reason, we should do more to create healthy forests. And yet, there's a report today that Washington State cut the amount of money that it is going to thinning and doing other things to reduce the risk of catastrophic wildfire in half, $60 million cut over the next 2 years. Well, instead of spending $22.5 million on planning and $4 million on more staff, why not spend it on forest health treatments, things that really would reduce the amount of smoke, reduce the risk to communities near forests, reduce habitat destruction? That's real tangible things, but we're not spending the money there. We're spending it on bureaucracy.
Yeah, because Todd, it also occurs to me there was a pretty bad fire in the Northwest over the last week or so, and it burned some people out. And every time I saw the pictures of where their homes used to be or where their homes are heavily damaged, I noticed they didn't exactly have a defensible space around them. Now, I'm willing to admit, I mean, I'll cut down small trees, but big trees, I hire somebody to do that because the big trees can fall on top of you or your house or anything else. You'd almost think that $22 million spent that way. If you went to the government and said, hey, I'd love to clear back a defensible space, but these big firs, they're 3 feet in diameter, they're 80 feet tall, and I'm going to drop the tree on myself. Could you help me out? And if they were willing to do that kind of thing, a small amount of money could make a major difference in whether or not somebody's house burns to the ground or not.
That's exactly right. And there are state programs that help people do what you're talking about, which is called firewising. And it's putting that defensible space. It's reducing the risk of fire around you so that if fire comes near your home or near a community, that they can defend it, that they can stop it before it hits that community. But again, you know, that money, we don't have enough of that money. And in terms of forest health, we actually reduce the amount of money available, but we're not reducing money to these other things. There's another sleight of hand that goes on, which is they say, oh, but we are spending money on things like childhood asthma. Like, that's really good. But the amount of money that they're spending to reduce childhood asthma out of the $174 million budget, $300,000.
Wow.
So things that they highlight, like fighting childhood asthma, are given tiny amounts of money. And the things that don't do much, like more bureaucracy, more planning, get the lion's share of the funding.
And the childhood asthma, if it's accentuated by the forest fires, so if you follow the logic, we have a warmer climate, which, and it's bad management of forests that are actually causing the fires. The fires will happen. The smoke will happen. The smoke will make the asthma worse. And none of what they're doing actually addresses that. But it says, but we'll go out and buy inhalers for a bunch of kids, or maybe get them an appointment with an asthma doctor who can take a look at their condition. But solving the actual problem that puts the smoke in the air, they're not doing that at all. That is Todd Myers. Todd is the Vice President for Research at Washington Policy. Todd, I always appreciate the time. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails. Coming up in a moment, in the city of Cincinnati, a terrible attack that I have a feeling the mainstream media is going to have a tough time commenting on, but the Vice President of the United States, J.D. Vance, he had no problem talking about it. That's next on the Lars Larson Show.
whenever you want it. Get the podcasts all day, every day at LarsLarsen.com.
How many of you all have wanted to go to downtown Akron or downtown Canton or downtown Columbus for a meal, but you're worried because the local authorities in these big cities have allowed lawlessness to run wild?
That is the Vice President of the United States, J.D. Vance, speaking about the fact that there was an incident this past weekend in Cincinnati. And what happened? There was a music festival going on, and a man and a woman were at the music festival. They were actually outside the venue. They were in the street. Something happened. There was some kind of verbal altercation, which became a beatdown on the man. I mean, the video is absolutely painful to watch. The man is a middle-aged man. The woman is a middle-aged woman. And the crowd begins to beat on him. And then the woman is hit right in the face. And as a result, he goes to the hospital. She goes to the hospital. So far, officials have yet to announce any arrests, even though in Cincinnati they say that they have identified four or five suspects who are believed to be involved in the fight. Now watch this, because the cartel media is going to describe this as a fight. A fight, I think, is when two combatants are both throwing punches or both able to fight back. I watched the video of this. This was a beatdown by several people who beat on the man until he fell to the ground, covering his head with his arms. And then there were people who kicked him and jumped on top of him. That is not a fight. That is a beatdown. And I think there's a big difference between the two. And J.D. Vance, he said, look, we got to prosecute these people.
So what I saw, and I haven't seen the full context, but what I saw is a mob of lawless thugs beating up on an innocent person, and it's disgusting. And I hope every single one of those people who engage in violence is prosecuted to the full extent of the law.
Well, as I said, the police say they've identified four or five suspects believed to have been involved in the fight. Not one of them, at last report, and that was maybe 2 hours ago, had been taken into custody. Police are continuing to sort through the tips to identify additional suspects. But when I saw the man go to the ground, even if you could argue, well, he threw the first punch, the minute that that assailant, if he was the first person to throw a punch, and he may not have been, but even if he was, the minute he is incapacitated, your ability to go up and legally kick him or jump on top of him and beat him further, that goes away altogether. The self-defense line only works as long as you're actually defending yourself. But J.D. Vance says decent people are having a tough time with this.
But the one part that I saw that was really gruesome is you had a grown man who sucker punched a middle-aged woman. And where I come from, at least, when you have a grown man who sucker punches a middle-aged woman, that person ought to go to jail for a very long time. And frankly, he's lucky there weren't some better people around, because they would have handled it themselves.
Yeah, they probably would have, except that's one of the biggest problems. There are multiple views of people who shot video of this entire incident. There was one man who appeared to be a white man who was trying to defend the white man who was being beat into the pavement by a mob of black people, black men, who were doing this. And I have a feeling the mainstream cartel media, they're going to stay away from this one as much as they possibly can. Because if this had been the reverse, if there had been a black couple that was beat on by a white mob somewhere in America, that story would be leading the national newscast everywhere. It was not that. So as a result, they will probably stay away from it. Let me go to John, who's a naysayer. Hey, John, you heard me talking about this gay couple, two men, who decided that they would order up a surrogate baby the way you'd order up a hamburger and fries at a fast food joint. And they crowdfunded it, so they raised the money by going online and saying, we're going to have this wonderful surrogate adventure. They then showed the little boy who had been born. And now we've come to find out, I'll quote Redux.com, which is a feminist website. They say one of the two men, and they show the picture that he has, is a registered sex offender. Should somebody who's a registered sex offender be able to go out and order up a surrogate child?
Well, that's not the thing I want to speak. You seem to impute a certain amount of cunning intelligence to these guys, and I think they're pretty stupid. You know, if they would have been smart, they would have just ordered and bought a kid from one of the cartels.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Is that what you're naysaying about?
Well, I didn't think they were very intelligent.
Have we really got to the point now where children are just a commodity? a commodity that you can order the production of, in the case of the surrogate, a commodity that you can just buy from people, because that became so popular when Joe Biden was president and he was letting hundreds of thousands of human traffickers come into America and the cartels to make all that money. Is that really where we're sitting now, John?
Well, a little less, because Kamala didn't win.
But, yeah, because if she'd won, it would have continued. And under Donald Trump, it's not going to continue. I think Trump's trying to do. In fact, Trump, when he was president, one of the things the mainstream media ignored, he signed one of the first real comprehensive anti-human trafficking laws into existence. But since the mainstream media had decided that everything Donald Trump did had to be seen as an evil act, they largely ignored what he had done.
Look, Doug. Biden was the best thing that ever happened to us. Cartels, they made a fortune with him, because didn't they charge all those people that came here thousands of dollars to bring him
here?
Yeah,
they did. I mean, the average person who came across as an average cartel escortee, if you will, somebody who was brought across the border, was paying a couple of thousand dollars. The ones who paid the larger amounts of money were brought across and were never in, they never encountered the Customs and Border Protection, because the coyotes who were guiding them would keep them away from the Customs and Border Protection folks, and probably for good reason, because the people that were being brought across that way probably had the criminal record. So the fact that the ones who actually encountered the Border Patrol didn't see a problem coming into a country illegally, knowing that you've got a criminal record that they can check. And the Biden folks, under Biden, all CBP and ICE did was say, yep, we've encountered a whole bunch of people who are on the terrorist watch list. We've encountered people with criminal violations from other countries, and they're simply being allowed in. And by the way, the story I just noticed late today is that in the state of Maine, there's a small town police department, and they actually hired a guy who is in the country illegally, and they hired him and put him to work as a cop. So imagine the irony that a proud country like the United States has towns where an illegal alien who came into the country 2 years ago was supposed to leave. He came in apparently on a tourist visa. He was supposed to leave October 1, 2 years ago, less than 2 years ago. And he stayed in the country and went to work in a town called Old Orchard Beach. And they have a small police department, and he goes to work as a cop. So you've got a guy who's illegally in the country, who's allowed to arrest Americans and enforce the law. And the only reason we know about it, John, you're going to love this. This man, John Luke Evans, working for the Old Orchard Beach PD, he walked into a gun store to buy a firearm. Well, if you've ever gone through that process, I've gone through it a few dozen times, you fill out a form called the 4473, and it asks you a bunch of questions, including whether or not you're a user of illegal drugs, whether or not you're legally in the United States. If you lie on any of those questions and then sign the form, you've committed a crime that's the equivalent of perjury. You can go to federal prison for up to 5 years for signing that form with inaccurate information. Well, all of a sudden... unless you're Hunter Biden. Yeah, all of a sudden, ATF sees this, and they say, you've got an illegal alien who's also a cop in a gun store in Maine trying to buy his own pistol, and either signing it accurately and admitting he's an illegal alien, or signing it inaccurately and committing a federal crime. That's
the
Joe Lewis Biden's
Larson
America.
Show. All the wokey snowflakes. Yes, you are probably going to be offended. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I guess it's no surprise, and it shouldn't surprise us, that the Biden administration was going after parents who tried to engage in use of their free speech rights under the U.S. Constitution. But now we're finding out more information about just how far they were willing to go after honest, law-abiding citizens who simply wanted to go to, say, a school board meeting and sound off on the kind of job that the schools were doing or were not doing with their children. Sherry Few joins me now, president and founder of United States Parents Involved in Education. Sherry, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
I know that there were a lot of parents, and I'm a grandparent, but I got very angry when I found out that the federal government under Joe Biden was trying to tell the DOJ and the FBI, these parents who show up and sound off at a school board meeting about things that really are truly objectionable, we should go after them. They are a terrorist threat to America. But what have we now learned about what Joe Biden and his government agencies were doing?
So what we learned is documents that were obtained by America First Legal, they made a FOIA request, and they received quite a few documents, some emails and some other information that supports the notion that the domestic terrorist memo, if you remember, it came out in 2021 from the Attorney General's office. And so apparently by the emails they've secured, they were looking for any possible way to go after parents who were concerned over, you know, the COVID virus mandates, critical race theory, and other things. You know, it's been, that era has been referred to as the Great Awakening of parents, and it's exactly what it was. When the COVID lockdowns were instituted and mandated, parents were able to see what their children were learning and were appalled by some of the nonsense. And so they were pushing back. They were going to school board meetings because they didn't want their children to have to wear a mask for 7 or 8 hours every day. There were real serious health concerns and suicide and mental health issues going on. And these parents were speaking out at school board meetings, and that's when the Attorney General got involved. It was prompted by the National School Boards Association, who you may recall wrote a letter. They're the ones that used the term domestic terrorists and referred to parents that were speaking out at school board meetings as domestic terrorists. And by the way, that backfired on them in a big way, because after that letter came out, they even sent another letter apologizing, because many of the school boards around the country just disassociated themselves with the National School Board Association. So I'm really glad that that backfired on them. But now we're learning that the Biden administration, the Attorney General, they were all colluding with the National School Boards Association to try to label parents as domestic terrorists and penalize them through the federal government, which obviously there's no federal action in this. This should all have been handled locally with local school boards, local law enforcement if necessary. And so the Biden administration, we have learned now, we're definitely colluding even up before that memo was released.
And by the way, Sherry, I mean, I want to get this detail straight so people understand it. Did the DOJ or the FBI or the White House have any legal basis for going after the parents for simply speaking at school board meetings?
Not at all. Not at all. And it should have been a local issue. And these emails that have been uncovered show that they were actually trying to find a federal way legally to get involved. But some of the information in the emails show that even some of the Biden administration staff pointed out that there was no legal standing for the federal government to become involved. And really what they're wanting to do is deprive parents of two fundamental rights, the right to speak and the right to direct the upbringing of their children.
Well, and the other piece to this, Sherry, you correct me if I'm wrong, but the way I recall what happened was that NSBA, the National School Boards Group, did not just spontaneously decide to write the letter, but that it was actually the White House saying, basically, we need to create a record with which we can use it to go after these parents. So your school boards are finding this problematic, that parents are showing up and telling them, you know, we don't want you to do this, and they have a right to do that. So the White House has effectively communicated to the NSBA, write a letter, send it to the Attorney General, then the Attorney General can use that as the basis on which to act. So you're creating a reason to do it.
Yes, that's exactly how it unfolded. And so they colluded with the National School Boards Association to have them write the letter so that that would be their basis. Again, that's where the term domestic terrorist came up, was in that letter. So the National School Board Association was saying that school board members and school officials were being threatened and attacked and potentially harmed. And that's the reason that they said they needed this federal intervention, was because they needed to help protect the school board members from harm. And so the opposite was actually true. And by the way, there's a new organization called Parents Demanding Justice Alliance. It's co-founded by Kelly Walker and Sam Sorbo, and they had a press conference last week, and they delivered a dossier to the weaponization work group that was formed by Pam Bondi. And so it is the testimony of several dozen parents and their how they were, the government was weaponized against them, and all of the things that they suffered. I mean, parents were thrown in jail. There were gag orders, other legal issues that cost them tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees to try to protect themselves. They lost jobs. They lost their businesses. I mean, it's outlandish. I've been reading through this report, and I'm so glad that this group has come together and are requesting this weaponization task force to review all of these cases and exonerate these parents. Their records need to be made clean, and anything they've suffered, they need to be rewarded in exchange for all of the suffering they've undergone.
Well, Sherry, I don't know about you, but one of my if I have a frustration with the Trump administration is that nobody's been arrested, nobody's going to jail, nobody's being threatened with prosecution. And I think some of these people, when they went that far out and they conspired, let's engineer the evidence, we'll get this group to write a letter, then we'll respond to the letter by doing this. That's a conspiracy. And I honestly think that somebody ought to be prosecuted for it. And as of this date, there's nobody who's being pursued. And that applies not just to this issue, but to a bunch of issues where you have a government that's out of control under Biden. They act in a way that is antithetical to the God-given rights of Americans protected by the Constitution. And nobody has anything happen to them. Nobody gets prosecuted.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. That's absolutely what needs to happen, and I think I'm just hopeful that we're going to see that in the coming days. But I'm just so glad that this alliance has formed to take this information to the weaponization task force, and we'll be following this to be sure that there is appropriate action taken. And I'm really glad that you're having this on the air tonight so that people can understand what's happening, and they can even look up this new organization. I mean, there might be parents that are listening who have also experienced the weaponization of the government when they spoke out at school board meetings. So the more parents that get involved with this, the more power it's going to bring this movement. So I recommend to your listeners to look up Parents Demanding Justice Alliance.
That's a great idea. Sherry, thanks very much. That's Sherry Few, the president and founder of United States Parents Involved in Education. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
You are in control.
Our Constitution is a document in which we, the people, tell the government what it is allowed to do.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Remember I mentioned that incident in Cincinnati in which men and women, all of them black, were stomping on a white couple, a man, a middle-aged man, who was knocked to the ground and then stomped on, kicked in the head, kicked in the gut, body slammed into the pavement and just beaten down to he couldn't do anything. Nobody's stepping forward to help him out. I'd mentioned earlier that nobody had yet been arrested. Well, five people have now been charged in this case, and that's a good thing. Although the police are saying we will not release the names of the suspects, and the police chief, Teresa Feetg, I think is the way you pronounce her name, T-H-E-E-T-G-E. She is refusing to say what they have been charged with. Now, you know, This is the part that seems kind of unbelievable to me. You've got a major incident. It's made your town look horrible to the rest of America. You've had a gigantic increase this year in violent crime in Cincinnati, while the rest of the country is seeing a slight downtick in violent crime. And you have this thing happen, and then you come out and say, well, we've arrested five people, but we're going to bring charges against them, but we're not going to tell you what their names are, and we're not going to charge you, we're not going to tell you what they are charged with. They also say they may be arresting some more people. They said, we have five that have been charged, and we anticipate more. The police chief, by the way, is an older white woman who runs the police department in Cincinnati. I think that this one is one where I usually tell you that I usually refer to somebody's race, religion, national origin, or physical disability only when I think it is relevant to the story. So you have a large crowd of people, and some of that crowd, looks like about a dozen of them, decide to beat on a man who's already cowering on the pavement. He's been knocked to the ground. He's not capable of fighting back, and they continue to kick him and drop on top of him, body slam him into the pavement, and all of them are black. Now, is there a component there? It makes me think, if this had been the reverse, if a large group of white citizens had decided to beat on a black person, that would be the race issue would have been raised. But in this case, apparently not. And yet, at the end of all this, the police chief refers to this as a fight. Now, I don't know about you, but if I said, I saw two men fighting, I'd say, well, one man is throwing punches, the other man is throwing punches back. When you've got a group of half a dozen people who are beating on one man, and he's already gone to the pavement, he's already apparently incapable of even defending himself, I don't call that a fight. That is a beatdown. And what does the police chief go on to say? She says, outside of this one incident, an amazing success story for this city. They were having a music festival and a baseball game in Cincinnati that night. She says it went really, really well, other than this one couple that was beat down. Now, the woman, the video of her getting cold cocked is absolutely painful to watch. This is a middle-aged woman. She is not arguing with anybody, or if she was, it's difficult to tell. And a man comes up and just punches her in the jaw, knocks her to the ground. She is out cold. And the police chief says, yeah, except for those two people who got beat to the ground, a man and a woman, by a mob of people. Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, the play was very, very nice. Let's go to Ron. Hey, Ron, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Lars, I just heard what you talked about. And first of all, DEI hires, I can stay off the boat.
That's what I'm thinking about, the chief in that case.
And I'm going to put it right there and put the dagger in the neck. We got a civil rights division in the federal government. It is time to go ahead and have those people, 10, 12, 20 people, charged with violating those people's civil rights. Because that was, in my opinion, was very racist. Be no different than me growing up in Fontana, California, watching them do it to black folks or Mexicans or Irish or even Asians. And to me, we need to be proactive, not just talk about, put some action behind the words when we say something.
Here's the thing, Ron. There are plenty of times that people have said things to me to make me mad. Is any set of words, would it justify me punching them in the face? Absolutely not. And so when this woman is standing there, I don't even care what was coming out of her mouth. I don't know what she had to say to the people who were there. But when a man comes up and punches the woman in the face, knocks her out cold, and then the police chief was lecturing the press. This is the police chief in Cincinnati saying, she is saying that the video only shows one version of what happened. Well, Ron, I think you and I have both seen videos over the years where you say, okay, that's one view. What happened right before that? But if a woman is standing there and she's not at that point assaulting anybody else, she may be talking, but that's all she's doing. Is there anything that you need to see beyond that to see that when somebody walks up and just cold cocks her one, in the man who was then beat down to the ground, they're holding him by his elbows. The one guy's got, looked like a kind of a full Nelson on him from behind, holding his arms back. So then he's beat to the ground. You know, you're talking about a situation where a group of people decide to take out whatever anger they've got on two individuals and saying, well, you're only seeing one part of the story. I'm sure we're going to hear all kinds of things. Well, they said this and they said that. I don't think any of that is relevant. If you say one of them physically attacked somebody and that person fought back, that would be legitimate. Simply beating a man to the ground for no apparent reason, that's not justified at all. And if Cincinnati does not throw the book at these two, then Cincinnati should be ashamed. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson.